Happy to be here. I apologize that, especially to the organizers, I'm not able to attend like the whole big chunk of time, but I'm here. I'm glad to be here and happy to talk to anybody who wants to talk to me about stuff later on. So let's just jump right into it, okay? Everybody ready? We need some morning stretching exercises? No? Good. So I'm going to talk about electrical signaling in biofilms, and I'm going to start with one of my favorite experiments. Right, this is Luigi Galvani, and if you notice, there's a sort of a creature right there, and I know there's theorists in the audience, but I'm sure that everybody can very esteemingly tell that a critical part of the animal's missing, right? And you notice that Luigi is holding there something, right? And he's touching down on something, and what's going on here is basically, when he touches this, he's going to connect an electrical circuit. Okay? And when he did this experiment, he saw that these frog legs started to twitch. Okay? You have to put yourself back in this century. Okay? And there's this guy, and he has a dead animal, not even a complete dead animal. Like most critical parts potentially missing, depending on what your favorite parts are, right? And he can bring it back to life, so to speak, right? He can get this to twitch. This freaked out people. It inspired a lot of scientific research, but also a lot of sort of popular imaginary things. Like Frankenstein is based on Luigi Galvani's experiment. If everybody remembers, they always shock the monster with electricity to bring him to life, right? That's the origin. Why they're using electricity, right? And so this was really the beginning. There's been other people before him actually who started doing some of these sort of experiments where they were looking at the interaction between electricity and biology, right? But this is really one of the earliest examples. And this led then to all kinds of progress in biology, and especially in neuroscience. Neuroscience then just took off, right? With Ramon Cajal doing all those beautiful drawings and figuring out that neurons are involved and so forth. And so that dominated the field, right, of how we think about stuff. So when I say electrical signaling, right, everybody should think about the brain. Okay? And when we think about the brain, we clearly think about sort of this tissue that has millions and millions of neurons that are electrically communicating with each other to execute sort of complex behaviors and computations and things like that, right? And what's interesting is, or what's important to know is that this is the molecule that allows electrical signaling in the brain. Maybe some of you recognize this molecule. It's one of the most beautiful protein structures you'll actually ever see. It's the potassium ion channel. Okay? And that's the selectivity filter up there and so forth, and there's a pore in the middle. Okay? And this molecule is responsible for electrical signaling in the brain. And this is Rob McKinnon. He's the person who solved the structure of the first ion channel, and it was the potassium ion channel. And he published that paper in 1998. For all the students here in the audience, I would urge you to read that paper. It's one of the most beautiful papers you will probably read in science. It's up there in the top 10 papers. And it describes this channel and how it works, how this channel can select potassium over sodium, which is was a big puzzle. And in fact, this was thought to be impossible, meaning people thought that no one could ever get the structure of an ion channel for technical reasons. And Rod came up with like beautiful tricks to get it done, and he got the Nobel Prize in 2003 after publishing the paper in 98, because it was such a major accomplishment at the time. And so many of you in the audience may in fact know parts of these things that I'm talking about, but maybe not everybody knows that the structure that he saw was not from a mammalian system, it wasn't even from a yeast or anything, it was from a bacteria, from a gram-positive soil bacteria, it was from Streptomyces. And since then, once he figured out how to solve these ion channels, a lot of people started to solve ion channels, different types of ion channels. And they were all bacterial ion channels, because you can get, for crystallography, you need a lot of protein. You have to purify it, and then you have to get crystals, right? And it's much, much more efficient to do this from bacteria. And so we used a lot of these bacterial ion channels to understand how basically the neurons work. In fact, drugs were designed based on these structures today that people take to treat neurological disorders based on bacterial ion channels. Okay? But in a sort of ironic twist, right? We had no clue what potassium ion channels do in bacteria. Okay? So even though we use these ion channels and we figured out how things happen maybe in the brain, some disorders even, right? People didn't understand what do bacteria do with these potassium ion channels. And so here's just from one of the sort of reviews from 2008, which I thought sort of expresses this point sort of in an interesting way, right? It says, it is ionic that the puzzling basis of ion specificity is finally solved in concrete terms with a channel from a lowly bacterium, right? So that's very important. We'll get to that. And its true function in the life of the bacterium is unknown. And so we said, so what is it that's missing, right? Like people have been looking at this. It wasn't like nobody was trying, right? But they were approaching it from the perspective of what is the purpose of a potassium ion channel for a bacteria. And a bacteria is a unicellular organism, so you would assume that the function for this ion channel would be at the level of a single cell, right? And so we said, what if it's not quite like that? Because the realization is that, right, that bacteria, even though they're unicellular organisms, they don't exist as these sort of Robinson Crusoes on an island by themselves. They're always surrounded by other bacteria. In fact, here you're looking at the organism that we study in my lab predominantly, which is Bacillus subtilis. It's a biofilm. Okay? A biofilm is a structured community of bacteria, extremely densely packed, and there's this marvelous biology to be discovered in there, and we just scratched the surface. We don't know much about it at all, in fact. Okay? And this is what it looks like, and this structure is rather large. So if you look from here to here, it approaches 2 centimeters. And so it's big, especially relative to the size of a bacterium. And so we said, what if the function of these ion channels was in fact operating at the level of such a context, which is a sort of a tissue-like structure, rather than at the level of sort of a bacteria swimming in an LV flask or something, right? And that would be much more analogous to what you have sort of maybe even in the brain. Okay. And so we developed a method to study biofilms in a more quantitative way. We sort of pushed the edge as far as we could with in terms of what people had done traditionally, which is grow biofilms on agar surfaces, and predominantly the early work was just to define mutants that altered morphologically the structure of these biofilms, because you can just very easily score phenotypes and so forth, right? So parts identification. But those methods, because you have to image the colony on agar surface, they're not very quantitative. We really tried and we figured out ways to get more quantitative by embedding fluorescent beads and using atomic force microscopy and all kinds of stuff. But it was clear we needed a better approach. And so we turned to microfluidics. The twist here is that it's not very micro, the fluidics that we're using. Okay, so we're using a chamber that's actually rather large. It's 3 millimeters by 3 millimeters. Okay? And the height is restricted to about 8 microns. And so the biofilm fills it up all the way to the top and it expands, so you get I'm a biophysicist, so reducing dimensions is something I like, right? So you go from a more like three-dimensional to a little bit more of a two-dimensional kind of biofilm, but you can still have a community that houses, because the chamber is so large, 2 million cells easy, 2 to 3 million, okay? And we can, in fact, the nice thing here is we can resolve individual cells even, okay? But the key thing is this allowed us to do much more quantitative experiments where we can control the media and things like that, right? The power of sort of microfluidics at our disposal. And I'll show you what we discovered. I'm just going to... a lot of the stuff has been published, so I'm going to go over it quickly. I'll be happy to answer questions if I'm not clear. So if you remember this image, so you see there's this sort of squarish thing. That's actually part of it's a PDMS pillar. PDMS is the polymer that we're using to create these devices. And when you're making a chamber that's 3 millimeters by 3 millimeters and the height is only 8 microns, you actually need a structural support for this thing not to collapse, right? And so we have those pillars as structural support, but more importantly, they serve for us also as a site of attachment Bacteria, these are undomesticated bacteria, by the way, so they're not the ones that you might be using for clothing. So they're very sticky, and they're very difficult to work with, and because they're sticky, they will stick to these pillars, and then they grow out from there. So we can create very reproducible experiments, which is very powerful. Okay? And so, here I'll show you what one of these looks like. So here again, you see this pillar. This is just tells us what pillar number it is, okay, so don't worry about that too. And then you can make out, hopefully, the edge of the biofilm. This is a movie. I'm going to play you the movie. And what's interesting here is we found a very nice fluorescent dye that allows us to detect the membrane potential of the bacteria. The way it works is that the dye itself is charged. Okay, it's a cationic dye, and so the dye will be inside the cells depending on the membrane potential, right? So the more negative the cell is, the more of the dye you have, the less negative, the less you have, okay? And so we can actually use this fluorescent dye to track at the single cell level the membrane potential, and especially the dynamics of the membrane potential in bacteria inside a huge biofilm, okay? And when you do this, and you'll see the fluorescence will be here in cyan. So what you're seeing here is something, I mean, it was really, truly astounding and amazing. Like nobody expected, in my group, expected this at all, right? In fact, we thought that this is some weird artifact, so. In fact, when my postdoc came, I said, just go do it again, right? don't even bother me, right? But he kept coming back with better controls. And so you're seeing here a collective dynamic modulation of the membrane potential of millions of bacteria in a community. And you can see there's sort of these patterns and waves and things like that. And so, how does it work? Okay. So I'm going to go again. This is published. I'll go very briefly over it. Okay. So there's actually a process that triggers this. So the biofilm doesn't always do this. In fact, this is an emergent phenomenon, in the sense that the biofilm community will only start exhibiting these dynamics once it reaches a certain size under these conditions, okay? And that size is extremely reproducible, and only once it gets to that size does it trigger this sort of these electrical memory potential dynamics, okay? And so, what is it about it? Like, why is it starting at a certain size, right? And so, it turns out, what determines it is sort of a competition between diffusion of nutrients, okay, and consumption of nutrients by bacteria. So this biofilm in our device is such that it's trapped between two surfaces, and so food comes from the outside, okay? And the interior of the biofilm, when the biofilm is very small, has plenty of access to nutrients, okay? Imagine there's just 10 cells, right? No problem. Diffusion is plenty fast, everybody gets food, okay? 100 cells, no problem. But at some point, you start to get big enough, right, where not only is there sort of a longer distance to the source of the nutrients with respect to cells that are in the interior, right, but the peripheral cells are also consuming the food, right? So less food comes, these guys start eating it, less diffuse, so the interior becomes pale here, right, which means that they're being starved. And we figured out that in particular they're being starved for this very critical amino acid, my personal favorite amino acid, glutamate, okay? It's a charged amino acid. The other thing that's really cool about it, you can find it in outer space, right? And it has a beautiful structure. And the other reason why it's really interesting is that half of your brain activity right now, even if you're sleeping in the back, right, is controlled by glutamate. It's an excitatory amino acid. It can elicit responses in neurons. Okay? And so because of its charged nature. And so the bacteria that are trapped, sort of, if you will, or buried in the inside, right? They're being starved for this amino acid. And then we identified this ion channel. It's a potassium ion channel. And it has a very interesting gating domain. So a gating domain is a part of the ion channel that controls the open and closed probability of an ion channel. So ion channels are very dynamic. They will flicker, actually, between open and closed states, which means that it affects the flux of ions through the channel, and the gating domain can modulate this probability of on-off, okay? And this gating domain is called the Torquay gating domain. It's very prevalent in bacterial ion channels, And these Truncate domains bind secondary metabolites like NADH, GDP, FAD, okay? So these types of molecules that tell the cell something about its metabolic state. And when these bacteria start to glutamate, we showed that it opens up the ion channels, okay? And these bacteria will release potassium. Okay, it's a potassium ion channel. It's open, so potassium is going to go out. It's going to go out because bacteria, and in fact, all living cells hoard potassium. Tons and tons of potassium. Bacillus subtilis will have typical concentrations of around almost 400 millimolar potassium on the inside. Okay, so it's a huge amount of potassium. And when you open the ion channel, you're going to release some, right? Because there's a huge Nernst potential that would drive potassium out. And so that's the trigger. The trigger is really the starvation of the interior of the biofilm for glutamate. That's then allows these or forces these cells sort of to open the ion channels and release the potassium, right? But you saw in that movie there was sort of a huge sort of collective dynamic synchronized thing happening, right? So that means that there's some kind of cell-to-cell communication, right? What happens? So if this cell releases its potassium, let's see what happens if there's a cell next to it, right? So if I'm a cell next to it, and my neighbor, right, there's Aragal, right? So let's say I just dumped my potassium on this poor guy sitting here because he was foolish enough to sit in the first row, right? Now what's going to happen to you? The first thing is you're going to depolarize. You're going to look pale, right? And so when you depolarize, right, something very important happens, which is your uptake of glutamate is reduced. So the reason why that is, because charged molecules cannot just simply go across the lipid bilayer, okay? It's energetically unfavorable because the lipid bilayer has a low dielectric, okay? And so bacteria have evolved specific mechanisms to take up charged amino acids. In Bacillus subtilis, there's a molecule called GLTP, okay? And it takes up glutamate, it co-transports it with two protons, okay? And that's how the bacteria take up glutamate, is using basically something known as the proton motive force, and we're going to come back to this, okay? And if I depolarize the cell, I lose my proton motive force, I'm less able to take up glutamate from the environment, okay? And that means that if I'm not able to take up glutamate efficiently, right, then what's going to happen? I'm going to experience glutamate starvation. What happens if I experience glutamate starvation? I'm going to open my ion channels, I'm going to dump my potassium, and then the next cell is going to go through the same cycle, and so you get this domino effect. And this is going to propagate through the community. I'm not going to show the movies, but we have these beautiful waves where we can actually track extracellular potassium, and we can see these waves washing over the biofilm. Okay?
So, sorry, but I mean, it's a very naive question, but so the proton motor force is a force that's causes positive charges to go into the bacteria.
Yeah, the proton motive force is the Nernst potential of protons distributed across the membrane.
Right, so that means that positive charges should go in.
That's right.
And then the K is K plus?
Yes.
So it's a positive, so but it goes out when
that's you, correct.
When you open.
That's
correct. Because there's such a high concentration of potassium that even though there's the proton motive force, it will still go out.
That's right.
Despite the potential.
That's right.
Of the chemical.
That's
potential.
Right. It won't go out forever. At some point, it's going to reach what's known as the Nernst, the equilibrium, right? Where basically the charge, the interior of the cell will be so negative that even if there's a chemical gradient, it won't be able to leave.
So it's a competition between chemical.
Yes, that's the Nernst potential. It describes an electrochemical potential. Yeah. Yes, please.
So why then does the potassium efflux collapse the membrane potential?
When you mean collapse, what do you mean by collapse?
When you say the membrane potential goes down.
The membrane potential, let's talk in terms of like, let's say more negative or less negative, which one do you mean? When you say down.
Well, the difference, I mean, if you measure, let's say 180 millivolts.
So when potassium leaves the cell becomes more negative. So actually,
that's true.
Its membrane.
I thought you showed in the movie that you basically collapse the membrane.
I'm not showing you any collapse. It's a dynamic process. So cells becoming hyperpolarized, and then they go back to their resting potential. So they're basically dynamically changing their membrane potential.
Do you know what range this is?
We have some rough estimates, but it's actually not super easy. So we're developing new methods to have sort of more like real numbers, if you will.
So what are the rough estimates?
The rough estimates, where we think we're talking anywhere between like 50 millivolts to maybe 80, something like that, but don't quote me on that.
So in E. coli, there are five glutamate transporters, and the major ones are actually ABC transporters. So presumably that would not be so affected by this effect. In Sutherland's, is it the only one?
So you like studying gram negative, this is the gram positive, right? And so there are differences. So it's not that potassium cannot get in any other way, right?
No. I mean the glutamate.
Oh, you're talking about the glutamate.
Yeah.
Right? So glutamate can get in through other ways also,
right.
But this is really in Bacillus subtilis.
Right.
The GLTP molecule is the predominant way. If you knock it out, it's not going to make it.
I see.
It's in the other mechanisms, which there are some. So I'm not saying there's none, but they're insufficient to sustain sufficient uptake of glutamate in Bacillus subtilis.
Because this effect needs to overcome the cell's need to take in glutamate. Right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So yeah.
A very nice question. So why is glutamate limiting
the so we'll get into that. Yes, they can make some glutamate, and we're going to use that later. We're going to actually have some mutations with that. It's not naive at all, right? But it comes down. It's not a naive question. It just comes down on sort of what are you trying to accomplish, right?
So glutamate is the natural source, right?
Yes. So I forgot to mention it. Yes, thank you very much, Terry. So nice of you to remind me of these critical points that I forgot. Absolutely. In fact, glutamate is the most critical nitrogen source, especially for Bacillus subtilis. About 80% of all proteins derive their nitrogen from glutamate in these bacteria. Okay? So you have to have. You can do it in other ways. But glutamate is really sort of a critical nitrogen source for these bacteria. Okay, so that's sort of just a brief overview of the mechanism. Okay, and so this is sort of a new type of electrical signaling in bacteria. Yep.
What is actually the time limiting step here in this? Is this the fusion of the potassium ions?
The time limiting step actually turns out to be not that. Potassium actually diffuses rather fast. So what drives the oscillations, if you're asking me about the time scale of the oscillations itself at the population level, the slow time scale is really sort of a combination of consumption and diffusion of the nutrients rather than the potassium itself. So it's a spatially extended negative feedback loop where the interior and peripheral cells engage in sort of this sort of a trade-off, which I will describe in just a few slides. And the slowest part of that is sort of the consumption and nutrient diffusion. Okay. So with this electrical signaling, we can basically draw sort of an analogy, right? Which is that, remember we started off saying this is sort of what everybody thinks about in terms of electrical signaling, and then potassium ion channels are the critical molecules that allow any of this to happen. And so now we think that not only are there structural similarities between potassium ion channels in the brain, and in bacteria, because since the early days of sort of solving these structures, which is not even that early, right? It's only been less than 20 years. People have finally begun to also solve structures of even human ion channels, versions of these, and we find that they're structurally basically identical, right? Which makes sense. They have to be, at least in terms of selectivity and conductivity and things like that. But so beyond the structural similarity, it appears that there may even be a functional similarity in the sense that bacteria may use these potassium ion channels also for communication. Okay? And so I haven't told you yet for what end. What is the purpose of this? Okay? So, yes. Oh, I thought somebody was thinking. Okay. So, we're going to get into that, okay? But before we get into that, what we realize is that if we're looking at a process that is very similar to what's happening sort of in the brain, right? Let's just call it very loosely sort of an action potential in a biofilm. Okay? Then we should be able to go back to these incredibly awesome scientists, right? And I think, Andrew, did you know them personally? I think so, right? No, you're saying you're not that old.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
This is Hodgkin and Huxley, of course, right? And Hodgkin and Huxley, aside from having beautiful lunch. Is that a typical British lunch?
Oh, yeah.
they're the godfathers, if you ask me, of sort of quantitative systems biology, even, right? Because they did these beautiful integrated experiments between coming up with mathematical descriptions and beautiful experiments to tease out the mechanism of the action potential. And it's still, their Hodgkin-Huxley model, mathematical model, is still the gold standard of used in neuroscience today. And so we wanted to know is if we can take our observations, and we have some mutants, so we can actually explore some parameter regimes, right? If we could actually use the Hodgkin-Huxley model to explain and sort of maybe even use it to make predictions about what's happening in these bacterial, in these biofilm action potentials, right? And so we turned to their formalism. We didn't go to the, there's a reduced version, it's called the Fuchs-Nagumo, which is a two-dimensional simplified version of sort of neuronal excitability. We went back to the original Hodgkin and Huxley, which they think of sort of the neuron as sort of an electrical circuit, right? So here the resistances are your channels, and GNA, for example, denotes conductance of sodium, right? And then you have a potential, which is your Nernst potential, and then you have current, which is ions flowing, okay? And this is sort of their formalism, and we came up with a version which was basically to simplify, okay? And the way we simplified it is we got rid of the sodium, because we did lots of experiments. We didn't know what was going on, right? What's going to happen? But it turns out that sodium is not playing a role in this, okay? It may play some role, but it's definitely not the critical role. In fact, there are no known sodium ion channels in Bacillus subtilis. Okay? And it's not shocking, because there's actually lots of organisms that don't have sodium ion channels at all. So potassium ion channels evolved before sodium ion channels. Do you have a question?
Where's the non-linearity in this?
In what? In the
are the equations linear?
Sorry?
Are the equations linear, or are they...
No, it's an excitable system. Yeah, because there's a non-linear sort of gating of this. I'll show you. So ours is much simpler. We basically don't have the counter ion, and I'm sure somebody's going to ask me about it, and we can talk about it later. But one of the key differences other than that is that, you know, the ion channels in your brain are gated by the membrane potential directly, and we assume that in ours it's gated by basically starvation, by metabolic limitations, okay? Other than that, we're using the same sort of formula. And
so what is small n in the equation?
Let me see, what is it?
It's the
number. This one?
Yes.
Yes, that is your gating. So we're using that parameter, that's sort of what controls the flow of the current here, the conductance. So the conductance depends on the metabolic stress.
These gating variables are often referred to in terms of the capacity of that channel to allow flow. So I'm just trying to understand, for in your case, what is that? You need a slow, because it's an excitable system, you need a slow time scale in order to get the excitation and the relaxation. So
You have to reset the system, that's a slow time scale.
So what is that, just so I understand mechanistically, what is that slow relaxation in your case?
So you have to reabsorb the potassium into the system to reset the system. That will determine your refractory period. So the bottom line is we can actually use this reduced Hodgkin-Huxley formalism, and we can not only qualitatively, but pretty quantitatively actually recapitulate our observations, and we use it even to make predictions and things like that. But that was just sort of a side note, which is very exciting to me personally, and I know that there's a lot of theory-oriented people, so I thought it was really cool that we could use that neuronal model actually. Yes,
sorry. If you started talking about it, you should talk just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So you wrote down an equation, voltage, but so what are the relevant variables? Potassium,
yes.
So we're going to write down some equation for
efflux
and efflux,
right.
Fusion of those other two, and we're going to make those channel opening probability dependent on
the
potassium. Is that correct?
Yes.
Or voltage.
That's correct. Well, it's in our case we're saying it's not voltage. It depends
it's
on the glutamate.
It's not voltage sensitive, but glutamate sensitive.
Yes. Okay, so I know this is also a group that has an evolutionary perspective, right? A lot of you are interested in sort of evolution, so I thought it would be nice to put this in context, maybe from sort of an evolutionary perspective, okay? So what I'm saying is that basically, what we're seeing is that bacteria are able to coordinate their memory potential in space and time, okay, through this mechanism. And that's very, very interesting, okay? Because, so why is it important, right? So the memory potential is a very, very fundamental problem of all cells.
You need to
hit
the button again.
No, this is on purpose. Oh. Thank you. I do this because of people. Yeah, I think it's good sometimes to have a black screen. Right? Otherwise, you guys just get used to just looking at the screen. So forget the screen for a second, okay? It's on purpose. Relax. So why is it so important, right? So the memory potential is not just a property of neurons. It's not just a property of bacteria. It's a property of all living organisms, okay? Why is that? Why is that such a critical part of a cell, right? And what's really pathetic, I'm going to use a strong word, is that most of us study all kinds of cells and we rarely think about the memory potential when we do it, right? Unless you're a neuroscientist, then you go to bed and wake up with that thought potentially, right? But everybody else rarely thinks about that, even though it is such a critical determinant. And why is that? Why is it so profoundly important, and why is it so prevalent? So, there are theories about the origin of life. Okay. And obviously, no one was there, at least no one in this room, maybe. No? and so, there's going to be a running joke. Sorry,
it's all right.
I got to go with it now. Now I'm stuck, I have to go with it. And so, one of them is that life originated, right, in these alkaline hydrothermal vents in the deep oceans. Okay? And why is it, this is actually, there's all kinds of cool stuff, by the way. There's like crazy papers where people have shown that because you have sort of convection currents here, where the water gets heated up and then circulates back and stuff, you can actually run PCR reactions in this. Okay, through cooling and heating of the water, and because it circulates. Right, you can imagine sort of these sort of turbulent circulations here, okay? But in addition to that, something else is very interesting here, which is that, so if you think of these, and this the alkaline thermal vent here is in gray, okay? People think that the last Luca is your last universal common ancestor, right? These types of origins of life, if they happened here, right, they would have had natural gradients of protons. Okay? So the world ocean was much, much more acidic about 3-4 billion years ago. Okay? It was way more acidic, which means it had a lot of protons. The proton concentration in the ocean is very high. And these thermal vents are mostly alkaline. Okay? So you had this natural gradient of protons at these vents. Okay? And if you can have some kind of a separation, it doesn't have to be an organic membrane, right? Some kind of a bubble or something. You would have a natural gradient of protons across this separation, this sort of membrane, whatever it is. Okay? And people can in fact trace then the evolution of different ion channels. Okay? As I said, proton channels come first. They're the first to evolve. Second, potassium. Third, sodium, then it gets murky, and some chlorides, and some calciums, and divalent things, okay? But proton, calcium, sodium, we can clearly delineate in the evolutionary tree, okay? And so, only once these organisms manage to have those types of control, were they able to sort of no longer be restricted to living here, but they could pinch off and start becoming sort of independent organisms, okay? What that means is that the proton gradient, right, this electrochemical gradient, is very ancient, right? Does that make sense?
No. Because soap have an electrical gradient. You just have a concentration difference.
That's right.
There's no electrical component in there.
You need to pump something like sodium.
That's exactly right, and that's why the pumps start coming in. That's right.
And it's sodium, not potassium, that they're pumping under that scenario.
In this one, in this particular one, I'm not even sure that it's indicating which one it is. But
sodium is what you have to pump.
Actually,
in the seawater.
Right, but you, in fact, it's actually more powerful if you use potassium, right? Because if you use sodium, the ocean has a lot of sodium, right? So potassium is a much more sort of unique thing that you could use for you can sort of discriminate, okay? But we can get back to that point, okay? But suffice it to say that there was naturally occurring sort of these types of gradients which had a potential effect on the evolution of life. I think that we can all agree on, right?
Okay. I don't agree with this statement. I
mean, which statement?
Well, there's differences in pH.
Yes, that's right.
So,
yes.
Where are you going with that?
I'm saying that the differences in pH had a profound effect on the evolution of life.
Sure.
Okay, good. I'll take it. I take what you get, right? Good. And so here's Peter Mitchell, right, who won the Nobel Prize in 1978. For sort of providing an explanation. Well, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, which was great, because then you required no chemistry to understand this anymore. And so he showed basically that all cells use these types of proton gradients, the proton motive force, for generation of energy. Okay, this is as universal as the genetic code itself. That all organisms use this mechanism.
But this is fundamentally different from how you set this up. It's not just an external proton gradient.
Oh, no, I know.
Can I finish? This is a generated electrochemical proton.
It's a machine,
gradient.
Yeah. It's an ATP.
And it's really the electrical field. So,
not only
an external pH gradient, you can have sort of energy released while some protons go to the more alkaline compound, but that's not a sustainable process. So this model is based on an active proton pumping, and this is just recovering the energy that is stored in the electrical field of a proton.
Right. Actually, it's not fully. So we can talk about that later. Okay. So you can't separate the chemical and electrical properties of these things. Okay. So it is an electrochemical property. Okay.
Yeah. But the pH difference in this system is negligible compared to the electrical gradient.
No, it depends on which system you're looking at.
Well,
if
the pH inside is 7 and outside 7.2, that.
But it's different from minor pH and chlorophyll. So it's just factually different for different
systems.
I think we can maybe pick up that discussion over lunch or something. If you don't mind. Okay. Yeah. Is that good?
We'll see.
Okay. That's fine.
So can I just, as a student, asking a question? So just to make sure I get your point, though, is initially there was some chemical gradient, that then there was selection to of all these transporters that turned it into a more electrical.
Yeah, I was just trying to give you guys sort of perspective, okay? Because I wasn't there, unless you were there.
I'm either than you.
And so, all I'm trying to say here is, right, that there was these sort of electrochemical gradients naturally occurring at those potential origins for life in the oceans, okay? And that, if we think about that, right, they can have, in fact, a profound effect on the evolution of life if you're evolving under these conditions. Okay? And we can discuss the details if you prefer.
Okay, so sorry, Guru, also dumb ass question. You want an electrochemical gradient, you have your chemical from your pH proton thing, and your electrical comes from
the charge.
The charge, which comes from
the proton being charged.
Okay, so the same thing. The source is the same.
It's electrochemical, that's why I said you can't separate, in my opinion. Yeah. But anyway, so even if we can continue discussing sort of the details and things like that, I think we can all agree that membrane bioenergetics is universal. Meaning, all cells utilize electrochemical gradients for generation of energy, and that's a fact. So that's at least not for discussion. Okay, which is good. And so, what's interesting here is that I'm showing you guys that these bacteria have a mechanism and a means to coordinate each other's membrane potential, which means that they could have an effect on sort of their energetic state, their proton motive force, right? And so, because the proton motive force, especially in bacteria, in all organisms, but bacteria do a lot of the stuff with this proton motive force. They use it for various kind of purposes. Right? We shouldn't be surprised about what I'm going to show you next, which is that this electric, this cell-to-cell communication has, in fact, effects on these bacterial behaviors at many different scales, because it's tapping into all kinds of processes that are utilizing this sort of this memory potential. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this pump, the ATP that uses the proton motor force, yes. I mean, it's reversible, right? So, I mean, my view was that, for instance, for E. coli, they use ATP to create the proton motor force that they then can use, for instance, for motility.
Sure, that's exactly right.
Right, so, but you make it sound like it's the other way around. Like they use
I'm not making it sound anyway. I'm just saying that having these gradients, the membrane potential, right, is a critical component for the cell to derive energy. That's all I'm saying.
So is the example of chemotaxis?
Sure, because you need to churn your flagellum. We'll get into that. We're gonna get into that example.
And there are other examples of why they need this proton motor force.
Of course, yes. Numerous examples. They use it for, you know, for pumping in glutamate, for example, like I showed you before.
Okay.
Right. So anything that requires to overcome some kind of an energy barrier, right, like taking up a charged molecule, is co-transported with these protons. So it's sort of it's one of the currencies, energy currencies of the cell, if you want to think about it that way. Okay. Good? Good. All right. So I'm going to show you how this electrical cell-to-cell signaling has an effect at three different scales. Okay, this is sort of an example. Okay. We're going to look at what it does, because I still haven't told you exactly what it does functionally in a biofilm. And then we're going to see that it actually has effects at different scales as well. Okay? And so let's start with just what it does. What does it even do in the biofilm? Okay? So turns out that the purpose of this electrical signaling, right, is to actually increase the fitness of the biofilm. Okay? So when the biofilm grows, okay, these peripheral cells are consuming a lot of nutrients, which is starving the interior of the biofilm. And when these interior biofilm cells are starved, that's when they trigger this electrical cell-to-cell signaling. And then you have this electrical wave that traverses and depolarizes, if you will. It's a depolarizing wave, okay? And depolarizes the cells that are causing the problem for these interior cells. So it prevents the growth of these cells at the periphery, okay? And so you get this sort of negative feedback loop, spatially extended negative feedback loop, where the growth of the peripheral cells induces nutrient stress of interior cells. The interior cells then trigger this electrical signal, which then inhibits the growth of the peripheral cells. Okay?
Why would that enhance biofilm fitness? I mean, what does that mean,
yes,
actually?
Yeah. The reason why that's actually very important, again, I'm going over published stuff, so we actually measured everything and we have like beautiful data for all this, okay? Is that the interior cells are the most sheltered, okay? So they're the ones that if there's some kind of a chemical attack against this biofilm, okay, exposure to, let's say, hydrogen peroxide or some antibiotic secreted by some other bacteria, right? The interior cells are the ones that are sort of in this bomb shelter, okay? Because they're physically protected by layers and layers of cells. And this is not a speculative statement. Like I can show you later the data, okay? If that's actually what happens, okay? So if you attack this biofilm, you will see that the interior cells are much less likely to die from this attack. But these interior cells, right, they can die on their own if they don't catch a break in terms of being starved by the peripheral cells. So the peripheral cells do this conflicting thing where they're both protecting the interior cells, but they're also starving them to death.
Why would they want to do that?
It's not a purposeful thing, right? So you can't assign some kind of you can't think that there's like a grand strategy.
But that's what you seem to be wanting me to believe.
I'm not saying that there's a grand strategy. I'm just saying that. Sorry?
That this is somehow analogous to a brain, that this is a thinking...
I don't recall saying that.
Okay.
You can go back to the transcript.
There are many more cells in the bulk than on the periphery, right? So there's some length scales involved, right?
Well, I mean, the ratio of the bulk to the periphery changes
with the
size, right?
So does the whole thing stop oscillating when the colony gets to be too big?
Yes. So what you have is actually, first of all, there's no oscillations before this even becomes a problem. So that's number one. So the oscillations, this doesn't even start unless the biofilm reaches the size where this becomes a problem.
So when
then it starts
to enlarge, does it move out to just to its periphery?
Yeah, because you have a trigger that's at the center, so it just...
But when it gets to be very, very big, right?
Yes.
One of the two things is going to happen.
The period
the
slows
whole thing
down.
Will stop, or that oscillation will be confined to whatever perimeter, some characteristic length, right?
Yes. This is not a solution that works at all scales, if that's what you're trying to get at. Yes. So the oscillations will start. As the biofilm gets larger, we see that the period gets extended because the ratio of interior to peripheral cells changes, right? And the distances, the scale changes, right? So the period starts off like this, and then we can see it sort of slowing down.
Mm-hmm.
And when the biofilm gets too large, we're basically, you would think that something would happen, we can no longer continue with our measurements because at that point, it is filled completely, this chamber, and like the experiment is basically done.
Question number two is, so when the growth of the periphery is suppressed, do you see some enhanced growth in the
absolutely.
What's happening to the density as a function of that?
I'll tell you what happens, okay? So if you have these oscillations, okay, the interior, I mean, I could pull up some data if you, but I would have to go to a different presentation that I want to bore everybody. But the interior cells, okay, just start dying if there's no oscillations, because the peripheral cells can starve them to death, okay? And we can do this in various ways. So we actually have, since we understand the mechanism, we have control over this process, okay? And if you kill these interior cells naturally, meaning as if the biofilm continuously grows, the peripheral cells continuously use up the food, the interior cells become starved and starve to death, okay? And if you attack that biofilm, right, then you can very easily kill that entire biofilm because the interior cells are already dead. And the peripheral cells are easy to kill with an external agent, okay? Does that make sense? Right? Because the most, if you have like a tumor or something, like people are always having problems killing the cells that are buried within, okay? It's the same kind of concept here. But if the biofilm oscillates, the interior cells are not killed. They're not starved to death, okay? So even if you kill the peripheral cells, you have this interior population of cells that can really rejuvenate a new biofilm.
Well, maybe I also have a problem with two dimensions and three dimensions.
We can talk about that. We can talk about that. Like in three dimensions, actually, we showed in another paper that then other processes start to take shape. Okay, but that's beyond the scale. I'm just talking about this particular sort of regime. Yeah, there's like multiple questions. We'll start.
Maybe I missed it. So why do you need oscillations? Why don't the outer cells just like stop growth and that's it?
Yeah, because the biofilm also wants to expand. I mean, for these outer cells, there's plenty of room.
Ah,
right?
So the oscillations enable food inside.
That's right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yes. You were first, sorry.
So I think maybe one thing that we're arguing about is the meaning of fitness in this context, but...
So we just quantified it very simply. We said if you give them a certain amount of toxic chemicals, like antibiotics, whatever, what is the percentage of cells at the level of the population that survive, and then can they repopulate?
Because I mean, so one thing that you could think about doing is if you were to knock out that oscillating mechanism, do you see a greater increase in biomass? So that's make sense? So
no, not viable biomass.
Okay.
Yeah, because you have the interior starts to die, so
and
you
then,
do not. But you see that the growth of these, if you look at the average growth, right? These guys, if they don't pause every sort of period, right? Then you will see more growth, right?
So but
you will leave behind this sort of layer of growing cells. Behind them is then a wake of death because they're being continually starved to death.
So I guess my only other question in connection to that is that these are spore formers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little bit unimpressed with the idea of death for a spore former
in an
ecological context, right? So that's the only other thing that sort of comes to
mind. But this is these are different conditions. So meaning spore formation can happen, okay, even under sort of in our device under these kind of conditions, but it's something that happens actually much later, okay? One of the reasons that you shouldn't be too worried about this, the spore problem here is that spore formation itself requires actually a lot of energy. Okay? And so that assumes that the cell, even though it's detecting starvation, right, that there's sufficient amount of energy for the cell to reorganize and have the four spore formation. You have to synthesize protein. In fact, the protein coat is what covers the spore. That means you have a huge demand on nitrogen, okay, to synthesize all these proteins, which is not something that these cells are capable of doing.
I'm still very confused about some basic things. So my understanding is that the membrane potential of all these cells is such that the inside is more negative than the outside.
Right.
And now you're getting even more positively charged ions coming from your neighbor.
That's
why
correct.
Does this depolarize the membrane?
Oh, we can. That's a generic thing. This is not something specific to these bacteria that happens in yeast, neurons, whatever. It's just the act that if you have positive ions coming on the outside, some will leak in, and then it actually changes your nerve potential where you actually become less negative. Okay, and then that's a transient process because then these cells then open their potassium ion channels and they sort of compensate for it, and now you actually hyperpolarize, which means you become extra negative, and then the system resets. So you get sort of an action potential kind of looking blip in both directions. I can talk to you about that later.
If you have 400 millimolar potassium inside, in order to have, and you have cells even though it's a high cell density, if you have 400 millimolar, the concentration of external potassium will never be so much that it leaks in.
No.
Therefore depolarized.
No, I totally disagree with you. So what you're neglecting here is that it's not just, these cells are extremely tightly packed. So you're looking at sort of very, very small local concentrations.
Yes, but the point is it will never exceed the internal concentration. The external concentration.
Not.
And therefore you will not have a leak from external.
No, that is not right. Because you're just thinking about purely the chemical concentration, which is not the case. It's an electrochemical potential.
There is no electrical component. There is none.
Yes.
If you don't have not pumped this potassium outside from one cell outside, there is none.
No. Look, why don't we talk about it later?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
But all I can tell you is that even if you think about sort of the synapse between two neurons, the distance is very small.
Let's just
for a second take a break here, right? So the distance is very small. The distances between two bacteria in a biofilm can actually approach that of sort of synaptic distances, okay? Because they're packed, they're literally pushed against each other. And if you have an ion channel, and you don't have many of these, but you have local ion channels where you can release locally potassium, you can locally cause large changes in the concentration of the potassium. Does that make sense?
No.
Well, then I can't help you. Talk about it later.
I should probably move on because otherwise
yeah, yeah. That's fine. Right. Yeah, yeah.
I have a different question, but it's exactly on this interaction.
Sure.
Just very quickly, you're claiming that the irrespective of the details, out goes a wave, refractory period, in comes glutamate, which releases this stress. And so I guess that also suggests, because that's diffusing in, that the refractory period has to be longer than the characteristic time to move in. Otherwise, they've come out of refractory.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. Yes.
So that also applies some scales here over which this whole thing can operate.
That's correct.
I just understand
that. That's absolutely correct. Yeah. I agree with everything you said. Yeah. Good. So that also assumes, right? If you believe what I just showed you, right, then this was sort of the prediction that you would see. If you look at the growth of the biofilm, you would see that the biofilm would periodically pause its growth, right? And it would do so in a way that's anti-correlated with the electrical signaling, because, right, as when the electrical signaling is high, that's when the peripheral cells get hit, and then the growth rate slows down, right? And then the system recovers, and then so growth resumes, the interior cells get stressed again, then they release the signal, the growth slows down, and so you have these sort of continuous oscillations in electrical signaling and the growth, okay? Again, one of the problems is that, you know, I'm happy if you guys go look at the papers, because I'm skipping over here over lots of things. Maybe that was my mistake in the sense that I wanted to cover sort of a broader perspective, but there's a lot of details that I'm skipping over. I hope at least here you can in fact see by eye, if you look at the periphery here, you can see it sort of pausing its growth, right? And there's no reason for these cells to pause in the sense that there's plenty of food here and there's plenty of space here. And you see that they pause their growth when they're hit with the electrical wave.
Yeah. I thought that in Aspen, your postdoc was saying that they run a little short on ammonium at the edge when the cells in the middle are starving.
Yeah, so there's, as I said, I'm skipping over some details. So ammonium is another one of those charged molecules that actually is important for glutamate synthesis, glutamate being converted into glutamine. So that can also play a role, and it actually, in fact, enhances this problem. Okay. Because it has the same, it flows into the same sort of logic. If there's just another charged molecule here,
okay,
which contributes to this problem. Yeah.
Is it possible to force the wave by pulsing potassium?
Yes, totally. Yeah, and we do that and we show that. Yeah. Yeah. You can do it. You can trigger it. You can, for example, trigger the wave. If you take a biofilm that hasn't reached the size yet, and then you hit him from the outside with potassium, you can actually cause a wave going. Yeah. Okay. So now I'm going to show you something that I'm sure is going to provoke even more questions, which is fine.
You know, the other simulation was data or was simulation?
This is all
the one running on the
That's data. That's quantification of that actual life. So, if you have that's such a beautiful movie. We'll look at it, right? If you have one of these things, right, where you have these sort of waves of potassium, right, being generated in the biofilm, right? When the potassium hits the edge of the biofilm, there's no reason that it has to instantly cease, right? You have a diffusible molecule. And so we said, what if these waves can sort of propagate a certain distance away? Not a lot, right? But they could in fact exert some kind of an effect, maybe at some, maybe tens of micrometers, a few hundred micrometers, maybe, right, before the wave sort of, before the amplitude decays, right? And, you know, we know that biofilms form under many different conditions, and it is possible to find biofilms that are in aqueous environments. It's actually quite common, right? And in those conditions, you can have motile cells, right, that might be swimming around. So we said, what if that, if you have these sort of waves emanating from the biofilm, right, what would happen to those motile cells? Would they sense this? Would they respond in some way that would be similar to sort of what the cells are doing here? And then if you consider the fact that, again, that you're, if you're doing this, right, you would be playing with the memory potential of the cells, and that would affect their proton motor force, which, as you were pointing out, right, is very important for motility, right? It can control your tumbling rate, it can control your churning of the flagella, right? We said, what if it can affect sort of the motility of bacteria at a distance? And so here's we're zoomed in a little bit more. Here's the edge of the biofilm, and you'll see sort of the electrical waves sort of coming, hitting the edge, okay? And what we did here is that we introduced motile cells, and we wanted to make sure that we can discriminate which are cells that are sort of maybe potentially coming from the biofilm, maybe there's some cell that escaped or something, right? Versus the motile cells that are introduced later. So we marked them with a fluorescent label, which is red. Okay, so now I'm going to show you what the motile cells are doing.
So are the motile cells the same species?
They're the same species. Yeah. In this one.
What is the red color?
I just said it's motile cells. It's cells that are, these are motile cells that are not part of the biofilm community. They're swimming in this chamber. They're sharing the same environment with the biofilm.
But again, what is this red? Where is red?
It's M. cherry.
Oh, okay.
Considerably expressed.
What's the time scale of the wave? It's like hour.
It's like a couple hours, hour and a half to 2 hours. Yeah. So what you're seeing here is that periodically, right, coinciding with the electrical waves coming, you can see that there's an accumulation of motile cells at the periphery of the biofilm. Okay. And again, I'm going to skip over a lot of things. Okay. We can in fact modulate this. We can do all kinds of stuff, but yes, go ahead.
So M-cherry just labels itself.
M-cherry just labels itself. It just labels itself.
So you see cells swimming here?
Yeah, they're coming, and yeah, there's a periodic attraction to the biofilm.
So where are they going?
What?
Where are they going?
Back to the chamber. I'll show you. I mean, they're in the chamber, right? They're just swimming around. They're just either accumulating at the biofilm or not accumulating at the biofilm.
So when the wave comes, they get recruited to the edge.
That's right. Okay?
Transiently,
because the electrical signal is transient in nature, right?
It doesn't actually look like the moving front actually slows down. I can see the signal. I mean, if you go back one move.
Sure. I mean, we quantified everything. I can show you time traces if you want. So the signal comes, and then you see the accumulation. There's actually a slight delay between the signal coming and the accumulation.
Go to your previous movie without the red cells.
It's the same movie.
Yes, I know. It was kind of interesting to look at the rate
as well. Mm-hmm. There you go. What is your point?
Well, it looks like there's a uniform rate of expansion. If you look at the...
No,
you take your eyes away from the... From
no, but we quantify. Like, you can put your glasses back on or whatever, but all I can tell you is that as the wave hits it, you will see that there's a slowing.
Well, here the red ones are black, so it looks like the thing is growing because the red ones are coming in. So they're right. Black, so they match the...
Well, I'm looking, well, you know, yeah.
So just trust me, we quantify this. Good. So the mechanism that we can identify from this is that you have basically three steps that are sort of sufficient to understand what's going on. There could be more complicated things happening, right? But you have electrical signals being emitted from the bipolar that cause the membrane potential response in these motile cells, which we can measure, okay? We can demonstrate that. And we can, in fact, we have lots of mutants where we, like, change the amplitude of the electrical signal to show that it can have a causative effect. So everything I'm saying is actually not based on correlations, but causative for experiments where we can manipulate these processes. It causes a membrane potential response in motile cells and then modulates their tumbling frequency, okay? I'll show you, like, just one example, okay? So here you see in blue is the electrical oscillation measured in the biofilm, okay? In red, you're looking at the motile cell concentration using the red fluorescence, okay? At the edge of the biofilm within a certain range, okay? So we're basically measuring the concentration of motile cells at the biofilm edge in red, and in blue, we're looking at the electrical oscillations in the biofilm, okay? And so we said if these bacteria are really attracted to sort of this electrical signal, right, then what if we do an experiment, because we have a sort of a microfluidic chamber, and we can have situations where we have a biofilm growing on one side of this chamber, and we can actually flow an alternative, stronger source of potassium, right, to the other side, what would happen, right? So if you have the biofilm emitting its signal, can I load a much stronger signal far away from there and actually sort of redirect the cells away from the biofilm during one of these sort of oscillatory things, okay? And so here's what it looks like. So you see the biofilm is oscillating, okay? But during this oscillatory period, we're providing transiently an alternative source of potassium away from the biofilm, okay? And you see that there's no longer attraction to this biofilm, okay? And then when we take it away, then the cells go back, the motile cells go back to being attracted to the biofilm. Yes, Mark?
And the horizontal scale is time in minutes?
Yes, the x-axis is time.
Yeah, what do you know?
It's in probably hours. Yeah, I'll show you. There's another plot that's coming. It's part of a two-plot thing. So.
What does this strain of minimal potassium do if you're just in a uniform situation? What does it do to motility?
Well, I mean, you know, you're saying if it's not at a certain away from the...
I'm just asking, like, if you're just measuring uniformly, if you increase potassium in your chamber, let's say, uniformly, right? So does the concentration of cells, how does it modulate motility? No, what happens is that, let's say, if you say 300 millimolar and then the cells stop moving, then of course...
No, because the cells actually go to the alternative source. So if you notice here, there's actually not only non-attraction, but there's a little bit of a dip in this. In fact, here's what this is the measurement of motile cell concentration at the artificial source. And you can see that now you see a very specific attraction. So if it was the case that this potassium was sort of immobilizing the cells, right, then they could not go specifically to, then they would be just homogeneously distributed in this chamber. They would not go specifically to the
ultra because
just a spatially variable diffusion rate.
Yeah. So let's say if at one point And this is a small point. This is the instead of attraction, you have a case where the potassium is modulating the just the motion itself. Okay, so let's say you stop the motion, right, at high enough potassium concentration. Then those ones at the low region will still move, and then when they go to high region, they will stop. That's not necessarily attraction, but it will still have the same effect.
Yeah, we have other experiments also where I can show you that they actually, if you just wait a second, okay? It is not that. So here's a movie, okay, where you have on the left, this is going to be a real-time movie, so we're imaging here 10 milliseconds, okay? On the left, you have a biofilm that's emitting the electrical signal, so we're looking at a short time frame during the peak of electrical signaling being released from the biofilm. And on the right is during a trough. Excuse me, during a trough where basically the biofilm is not signaling, okay? So when the biofilm is not signaling, so this is real time, so this is how fast these guys actually move, right? So here, this is 10 micrometers. And now, this is during when the biofilm is releasing the electrical signal. Okay. I hope you can all see that this looks more like sort of ants swarming around some kind of a nutrient source. Okay, and of course we can be very quantitative. Okay, and we can track all these trajectories, thousands of them, and we can see that if you look at during a peak and a trough, that you see if you color code the trajectories based on their tumbling frequency, you can see there's a sort of spatial distribution. So it shows that you have actually not just some sort of passive thing, but that the tumbling frequency of these cells in space can sort of follow the potassium gradient of people. And
I don't know. I don't want you to see zero. The only thing I see is that there are less cells close to the biofilm, and so there are less cells in the region where the
I'm hoping that you can see that there is more red tape.
Yeah, but it's just because they are there. On the right, they are not there, so they don't tumble because they are not closing up. Well, that would be very
naive. No, because, it's not. There's actually a lot of space also in 3D for a single cell. It's not just that they don't have anywhere to go, if that's what you're thinking.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying they don't go that close because...
How much longer have you got?
I can stop. I don't care.
Another 10 minutes or 15 minutes?
I can stop now. I have no agenda.
It's just...
I can show you a few slides and then I can stop if you guys want.
You had these three scales.
Yeah, and you guys had a lot of questions, so
we're still on the second. Why don't we go to the third?
Okay. Well, let me show you this though, which is I think something that might be interesting to several people here. So if you have this mechanism that's based on these electrical signals, right, and it taps into modulating the tumbling frequency because it manipulates the proton motive force. What I showed you was Bacillus subtilis cells, motile cells being attracted to Bacillus subtilis biofilms. But we reasoned that this may not be just limited to Bacillus interactions because the mechanism could be more generic. And in fact, we can show that another interesting thing happens is that if you have this attraction, because the biofilm is a very sticky a tissue almost, right, a community where there's extracellular matrix components. And if you have cells that are being attracted, if I go back to one of those movies, actually, maybe some of you already know that some cells get trapped at the edge of the biofilm, okay? So they swim and they get stuck. And then they can become incorporated as the biofilm continues to grow. And what we find is that this electrical attraction not only works in Bacillus to Bacillus, but you can also have a Bacillus-Subtilis biofilm attracting Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And Pseudomonas and Bacillus can coexist in the soil, for example, right? And Pseudomonas is a gram-negative bacteria, so it's evolutionarily pretty diverse from Bacillus. And what you see here is, in red, you have, so this is the edge of the biofilm, this is the biofilm, you have Bacillus subtilis motile cells that were attracted and then incorporated into the biofilm. If you have a biofilm that has a defective electrical signal, you see far less incorporation, because there's also far less attraction. And here you see Pseudomonas cells being incorporated into a Bacillus subtilis biofilm. And again, that's electric specific, because if you use the same mutant with the deficient electrical signaling, you see less, right? And what's exciting here is that what you're looking at is basically a mixed biofilm forming through this electrical interaction, okay, this electrical attraction. So you have a species that settles an area, a territory, and then once it reaches a certain size, it can engage in this electrical signaling, which can result in recruitment of new members into the community, maybe even of different species. And the last thing I was going to show you, and I'll just show you like a teaser and I won't go through it, is what if you have two biofilms? Okay? So you can say this scenario, right? So the chamber now is at a size where you can house two biofilms, okay? So they're in the same chamber. And first, you'll see that when the movie starts, there's no oscillations once they reach a size. This guy on the left actually triggers first, okay? And then very quickly they become synchronized. And you have sort of this long-range coupling, coupled oscillators. And this actually is a little bit I think it's a really cool story, but I guess I'm out of time, so I won't be able to tell you that actually these biofilms will then end up modulating their oscillations to not be in phase, but to be anti-phase. And what that allows them to do is nutrient time share.
The flow is left, right.
The flow actually here is perpendicular. Sorry, it's up, down.
Can you show the movie of this?
This is the... Oh, which one?
Of them going out of space?
Yeah. Sure.
But you can totally go on for a couple of minutes, right? I was just afraid you were sort of only halfway through your talk. And
I mean, I have no agenda. I'm just here for your entertainment. So you have basically this electrical signaling, right, which synchronizes their stress states, if you will. Okay? And at the same time, though, these two biofilms, because they're sharing one sort of chamber, they have to compete for limited resources. And the resources here are limited because, you know, we're putting them into these stress conditions so they can form biofilms anyway. Okay. So if they're very rich media conditions, then these cells don't actually form biofilms. And so there's these two opposing, sort of, if you will, forces, right? You can see how this electrical signaling would promote biofilms to be in sync, in phase, I should say, right? And the competition is a force that would promote them to be out of phase, okay? And we can build mathematical models based on earlier sort of models that I showed you, which made this very interesting prediction. It said that if you change only the glutamate concentration, which is, the limiting nitrogen source, that the biofilms would go from being in phase, so here there's two traces plotted on top of each other in blue and orange, to now being anti-phase if you reduce the glutamate concentration by some number, okay? And so this is what it looks like. So here you have the standard that I showed you before, sort of glutamate concentration, and then here you see what happens when you reduce the nutrients.
What's the distance between the two biofilms?
It's about, it varies, right? As the biofilm grows, the distance shrinks a little bit. It's about 500 micrometers. Roughly. Yes, in the back, sorry.
And is the communication purely electrical, or it's diffusion of molecules between the two?
Well, it's potassium diffusing, so it's
This is not due to the fact that they already start at the phase, right?
No, because if I take these, and here's a situation where they're starting, where you have two pairs of biofilms. So the red is a pair, this is one biofilm pair, this is another biofilm pair. And you see that they were starting at sort of with a similar phase difference, right? But these are grown at less glutamate than these. These are synchronized because the phase difference becomes basically almost zero, and then these are approaching anti-phase. So it's not because of what you were suggesting.
And is this like a switch, or if you go at intermediate glutamate, the phase changes continuously?
It is pretty much like within that range. It is like a switch. But if you go to and it will persist. So if I go to some little even lower glutamate, it will stay. But if I go to extreme glutamate starvation and say like I remove all the glutamate, then of course all the growth stops. So then there's no dynamic. So that it sort of becomes. It just flickers and then everything dies out, right? And then likewise, if I take this glutamate concentration, I just keep increasing, I will actually get to a position where if I just have a ton of glutamate in the media, then the oscillations will cease because now the interior cells are no longer, there's so much glutamate basically that it overwhelms the biofilm that the consumption can't there's no problem anymore, and then the interior cells start offsetting or triggering these electrical things. Yeah.
So it means that the both biofilm feels each other at 500 micrometer apart.
Right.
And is there a distance where they don't feel each other?
Yeah, we try to do. It's very technically we're struggling with
yeah.
that. It's not like impossible not to make them, you know, sense each other. We can for example have very very extreme high flow rate, which sort of would then break the coupling, and we then see that this becomes. It affects the synchronization stuff. Yeah. So yeah, you can certainly break things. But just because if you guys want to give me a couple of minutes, if you hold your question, I'll show you something. So if you we have actually a way to make this interesting prediction. So if you look here at the communication strength. Okay. So this is the electrical signaling. Okay. And then you say here on this y-axis is the glutamate concentration. There's a very simple prediction, right, which is that if I weaken the electrical communication, but I keep the glutamate concentration the same, I should see the biofilm switching from being in-phase to anti-phase, right, according to this sort of prediction. And then, if I take this point, right, if I have this sort of biofilm that has some kind of altered communication that's weak, where now it would be anti-phase under the same nutrient concentration of glutamate, and now I increase the glutamate, I would then go up and it would be in phase. And we can in fact do this. There's a mutant where we can manipulate the gating of this ion channel, and we've shown that weakens the electrical signaling, and then we can say, let's take this mutant, increase the glutamate, you should recover the in phase, right? Similarly, we can do this where, because there's two forces, right? There's electrical communication, but there's also competition. So, you can say, what if I change the competition strength? And we can do this, again, right, what would happen? So if I change the competition strength, if I increase competition, I would move this point here. So even at the same glutamate level, I should go from in-phase to anti-phase, right? Because now the dominant thing is going to be competition, so it's going to force the sort of anti-phase oscillations. And we can do this. I think somebody asked about, like, can't the cells make their own glutamate or something, I can't remember. Yes, they can. There's this molecule called GLTA, which takes one alkylated glutamate and one glutamine and converts it into two glutamates, okay? And if you get rid of this enzyme, right, then the cells have, like, no chance to make glutamate at all on their own, okay? Even if they had some glutamine, although glutamine, you derive from glutamate, so there's some thing there, right? But without this enzyme, they would be extra dependent on extracellular glutamate, okay? So they would be hypercompetitive, right? And then if you take this strain and you increase the glutamate concentration, you would compensate for this competitiveness and you should recover in-phase oscillations, right? And if you take these two types of perturbations, you can assemble a surface where you have communication strength, competition strength, and then the glutamate, and the modeling predicts sort of a surface that separates in-phase from anti-phase oscillations, right? And these two lines are like what I showed you before. You would say that if you're above the surface, right, even though you can be at different glutamate concentrations, depending on your competition and communication strength, it predicts certain points where you would be in-phase or anti-phase, right? And so we see that here, if you notice, the glutamate concentrations are different, right? And when you go below the surface, you can see that you can, even though this is like 1x glutamate under which, for example, wild-type conditions are in phase, here now they're anti-phase, right? So we can actually experimentally verify this surface that shows you the phase separation, if you will, okay? And then you can say, does this actually have an effect on the growth, right? And so if the biofilms are doing this in-phase oscillations, right, they're actually consuming nutrients at the same time, so they have to do resource splitting. But if they do anti-phase oscillations, right, then they can do time sharing of the nutrients. And that leads to a simple prediction. So this is from a model, and it's very simple. So this is glutamate concentration, and then average growth rate on the y-axis. This is for a single biofilm. And what's here is very obvious, right? If I have some glutamate and I increase the glutamate, you will get more growth if there's a single biofilm. But it predicts that for if you have a pair of biofilms, even though you increase the glutamate, you will actually have less average growth. And the reason is because here they would be in phase, so they would be doing resource splitting. But here they would be doing anti-phase, so here they would behave basically as being independent biofilms, but here they're a coupled system, and so they would actually have reduced growth rate, and we can measure these experimentally. And we can show this very counterintuitive observation that if you increase the nutrients and you get into in-phase oscillations, that your growth rate is reduced. And I'll show you for fun, right, that if you, instead of looking at sort of the glutamate concentration, if you plot the phase difference, you can collapse all the different mutants and all the different things onto one relationship, which shows you that the dynamics are very sort of critical for determining your average growth rate of these biofilms. I want to end here, right? As I said, I'm skipping over a lot of papers, and I'd be happy to talk more about it over lunch and so forth, but these have all been published, so you can go and read the papers with very thick supplementary materials, extra movies, and lots of experiments that I unfortunately didn't get a chance to talk into. We also recently published sort of a snapshot, if anybody's interested in electrochemical communication. This is a very short, like a tiny mini review in Cell, where it's one figure and just like four paragraphs with 10 references, so anybody can read it. Okay. And so we're discussing here like different types of electrochemical signaling, and I know I'm out of time, but I have to acknowledge just a couple of people. Jordi García Ojalá was a physicist from Barcelona, and we do almost all of our work with him, although I'm sometimes working with Alex also, who's quietly sitting there. And then these are the principals of these studies. Arthur Prindle is the lead on the discovery of the ion channel mediated electrical signaling. Jing Tao then showed that this increases the biofilm fitness against chemical attack and discerns some of the biological functions. JC, a graduate student, discovered then the sort of long range effects and showed all these beautiful interactions, recruiting motile cells that can give rise to mixed species biofilms. And then Jing Tao also was the lead on the timeshare paper. And that's it. Anybody left with questions? Sir?
So actually, having two biofilm grains next to each other, and watching if they are in phase or in antiphase of growth is a good way to see if they are competing or not for this resource, for the resource which is in the medium.
Yes, that is correct.
So it's kind of a tool to see, if I put this medium, are they going to share or are they going to collaborate?
Yes,
spread the medium.